Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 478 for May 10th, 2014. Coming up in a few minutes.
We're really going out to 2027 with our distillation forecast in order that we can look at still capacity and warehouse needs and all of that thing. So it's very complicated on the far side.
Mark Brown is the CEO of Buffalo Trace and its parent company, Sazerac. His crystal ball is hinting at potential problems in coming years for the bourbon industry, which depends on a steady supply of new oak barrels, and those barrels have been in short supply lately. More with Mark Brown later on Whiskey Cast In Depth. I'll also have the calendar of events, your voice, and in the What I'm Tasting This Week department. Fagil is still a couple of weeks away, but I'll have my tasting notes for one of this year's Isla Festival releases, all on this week's Whiskey Cast.
Whiskey Cast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast. The definitive single pot still Irish whiskey.
Let's get started with the week's news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. There's a winner in the bidding for White & Mackay. Filipino billionaire Andrew Tan's Alliance Global Holding Company will pay about $724.5 million for all of White & Mackay, including the Dalmore and Tamnivoolan malt whiskey distilleries. Diageo and India's United Spirits had to sell White & Mackay to satisfy UK competition regulators. Diageo had hoped to hang on to Dalmore and Tamnivoolan to supply malt whiskey for the United Spirits brands, but settled for a 3-year supply contract with the distilleries instead. Alliance owns the Imperador Brandy brand, which is widely popular in Asia. White & Mackay will become part of Imperador, assuming that the deal is approved by UK and Indian regulators. Suntory didn't spend $16 billion on Beam to sit on the sidelines and watch. Just a week after closing the acquisition, Suntory announced plans to export its highly regarded Hibiki 17 and 21-year-old blended whiskies to the U.S. One of the key reasons Suntory wanted Beam was for its global distribution network, and this will be one of the first big tests. The Hibiki 12-year-old has been available in the U.S. for a couple of years now, but Suntory's Nao White says the older Hibikis have a little something special to them.
There's one component that both of them share, but there are two sort of different versions of them. That is the thing we haven't had readily accessible to us here, and that's the Mizunara Japanese oak. There is Mizunara present in both of the Yamazakis. It's not like the hallmark, because Mizunara, we discovered, is a barrel that needs a couple of extra years to really show. We really like it a little older, and having blends of this age that can really show off what this barrel is and why this oak needs to become part of our lexicon. I mean, there's not a lot of it around there, but it's some really unique flavors that whiskey lovers love.
Both Hibikis will be available in limited amounts on the East and West Coasts starting in September, with nationwide distribution coming in 2015. By the way, Beam executives were out in force at Thursday night's launch party in New York City. Suntory chief blender Seishi Koshimizu was the guest of honor that night. We sat down for an interview that will be featured on an upcoming episode of Whiskey Cast. Lots of other new whiskeys to mention this week. Jim Rutledge of Four Roses gave us some hints about this year's limited edition single barrel bourbon last month. Well, the details arrived just in time for this week's episode. It's an 11-year-old bourbon using one of Jim's 10 different recipes. If you're familiar with the codes Four Roses uses for those 10, it's specifically an OESF bourbon. Depending on the barrel, the strength will be anywhere from 54.15% all the way up to 63.8%. I'll have tasting notes for it in just a few minutes. Kilhoman is releasing the fourth edition of its 100% Isla malt. Like the previous three, it's made from barley grown on Kilhoman's farm and bottled on site, too. Back in February, Jack Teeling told us about his 26- and 30-year-old Irish single malts that were on the way. The Teeling Whiskey Company malts are now available at the Celtic Whiskey Shop in Dublin and the Irish Whiskey Collection Shop at Dublin's airport, and they'll be available later through whiskey specialist shops. The folks behind Master of Malt have created a new whiskey label under their Maverick Drinks unit. Darkness will feature sherry cask finished whiskies exclusively, starting with a 15-year-old Benrinis Oloroso sherry finish, a 15-year-old Macallan Pedro Jimenez finish, and a 21-year-old Ardbeg Oloroso cask. And Singapore's Changi Airport will get the first bottles of Johnny Walker Master Blender Jim Beveridge's latest creation. The John Walker & Sons Private Collection Series will be an annual release with 8,888 bottles to be available through travel retail outlets in Asia starting next month. The Spirit of Speyside Festival handed out its annual whiskey awards the other night as this year's festival was winding down. The awards were voted on by the public during a series of tasting sessions at various festival events. Benriach's 12-year-old Sherrywood malt took top honors for whiskeys 12 years and younger, while the Balvenie's 15-year-old single cask won for malts 13 to 20 years old. Cardew 21-year-old won in the category for 21-year-old malts, while Tamdhu's 10-year-old limited edition won the award for best distillery limited edition bottling. Next year's Spirit of Speyside Festival will be from April 30th through May 4th. Also from Speyside, the Murray Golf Club in Lossiemouth has a long history of linking whiskey with golf. Not surprising in Scotland. The club marks its 125th anniversary this year. It was founded by a group of distillers and lawyers and has now signed a deal with Gordon and MacPhail in Elgin to be the club's sole supplier of whiskies, spirits, and wines. That includes a 15-year-old Speyside malt that will be the club's 125th anniversary whiskey. And club captain John Elwood is proud of the fact that Murray is now the only club in the area with malts from every single Speyside and Murrayshire distillery behind the bar.
I think it's a good combination, Mark, because this is what we're trying to emphasize, that in terms of the best of Murray, that it's the overall experience. Yeah, people come to play golf. I know Americans particularly have got a lot of reverence and respect for the traditions and history of the clubs and of the whiskey industry. So that's why we're trying to make a combination of both to attract people to come and visit.
The club is open for public play, and so is the bar. By the way, Gordon and MacPhail Managing Director Michael Urquhart is a member of the club. John declined to comment on whether Michael is as good on the links as he is with whiskeys. You can hear the entire interview with John Elwood at whiskeycast.com.
The news is brought to you by Glenmorangie. Introducing Glenmorangie Companta, the fifth release in the Glenmorangie Private Edition range. A complex maturation in both Burgundy and Côte de Rhône French red wine barriques. Find out more at glenmorangie.com.
Of course, this is Mother's Day weekend. Father's Day is right around the corner, too. Don't forget about free shipping on all orders from the WhiskeyCast Photo Gallery between now and June 15th. Also, I'll be on the road later this month. Julio's Liquors in Westboro, Massachusetts is holding a special Ardbeg Hora Verdes release party on May 28th. That's 3 days before the official release party at the distillery on Isla. If you're in the Boston area, I hope to see you there. This week's Your Voice is brought to you by Johnny Walker. Got an email from Nate Berman in Tampa this week. Here's what he had to say. I was surprised just how much of the Orphan Barrel releases are available, in particular, the Barter House. One store near me received 90 bottles. This seems like an amazing amount of 20-year-old bourbon that was apparently just sitting unused. Do you know how much was released total, and does the large supply seem odd to you? Thank you for the question, Nate. Now, Diageo has never said just how many bottles of Barter House were released, but keep in mind that Florida is one of the states that tends to get a lot of limited edition releases from many distillers. Nate didn't say which store got those 90 bottles, but if you're trying to find some Barter House bourbon and can't, let me know and I'll try to find out for you. Bill Ricker in Boston had a comment on the sale of White & Mackay. He tweeted this note, "This looks good for at the nose. He isn't torn between Dalmore Whiskey and White & Mackay like King Solomon's Baby." Of course, the nose is the one and only Richard Patterson, and when Diageo was making noises about hanging on to the Dalmore, when it put White & Mackay up for sale, Richard was one of the employees that was slated to go with White and Mackay to a new buyer. Since Andrew Tan's Imperador is buying 100% of White and Mackay, well, that's no longer an issue. John Malatino in California tweets at SmokyPete1 and tweeted this note on the Suntory Hibiki 17 and 21-year-old announcement. Wow, that is awesome. Can't wait to try them. We need to get so many more Japanese whiskeys here in the USA. Well, John, I think your wish is about to be answered, and then some. Now, if we can only get Ichiro Akuto's whiskeys in the States. If you have a question, suggestion, or a whiskey wish list of your own, you can always share it with whiskey lovers around the world on the Your Voice page at WhiskeyCast.com. You can also find me on Twitter and Facebook at WhiskeyCast, or you can email me directly. My address is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. And this week's Your Voice is brought to you by Johnny Walker on the web at johnnywalker.com. Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. By the way, Laphroaig's Simon Brooking will be hosting a Laphroaig whiskey dinner at the Chop House in Gibbsboro, New Jersey, coming up on May 20th. The Isla Festival of Malt and Music, Fagil, gets underway on the 23rd and runs through May 31st. The annual Limburg Whiskey Fair is this coming weekend on May 17th and 18th in Limburg, Germany. The New Straitsville Moonshine Festival is Memorial Day weekend, the last weekend of May, in New Straitsville, Ohio. Whiskey Live Canberra is coming up May 30th and 31st in Australia's capital city. And the Kensington Wine Market in Calgary, Alberta, has its annual Spring Single Malt Festival on June 12th. Those are just some of the 250 whiskey events on the calendar right now at WhiskeyCast.com. It's brought to you by Laphroaig. Take a virtual distillery tour at Laphroaig.com. And while you're there, become a friend of Laphroaig and claim your own square foot of Isla.
WhiskeyCast, brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. In conversation with Tim Brennan, retired engineering supervisor, Redbreast single pot still Irish whiskey.
I've worked with Irish distillers for 40 years. I was born in Middleton and went to school in Middleton and then joined a company in 1971. Traditions in the old distillery were if you were involved in a very dirty job, you then got a half glass of Redbreast. There were the perks in the old distillery. We had one guy there who was particularly fond of his glass of Redbreast. And in order to go to the manager of the warehouse, he would get a really dirty bag of dust and he'd shake it over himself so that he looked so dirty. And he would head off over to the manager and say, "Mr. Daly, here I am. I've had a terrible dirty job for the morning. Look at the cut of me. Any chance of getting a half one?" And he'd duly get his half one, come back, change his clothes, and he was fine again.
Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey. Those in the know, know Redbreast.
Buffalo Trace CEO Mark Brown doesn't hesitate to speak his mind, even when it might cause some problems with his bourbon brethren. This past week, Buffalo Trace sent out a news release updating consumers on what Brown's team is calling a bourbon shortage with no end in sight. With 20% annual growth in sales for premium bourbons and stocks that can't keep up with that demand, not everyone is going to be happy. For instance, fans of the ancient age 10-year-old bourbon, sold mainly in Kentucky. It's a casualty of the bourbon boom, and there could be more to come, especially if the ongoing problems with sourcing new barrels gets much worse.
Well, on the AAA 10-year-old, it just got down to the point where the volumes were so small that it really wasn't commercially viable to bottle it anymore. It didn't. We had whiskey for it, but it got down to a point where you couldn't run it down the production line and then afford to sell it at the prices that it had been at. If you moved it to a hand bottling operation, it would have made the thing cost prohibitive. And so we finally, and I might add reluctantly, abandoned ship on it. I mean, we've dropped a couple of brands along the way, but they were very small brands and really weren't particularly a part. I remember Weller Centennial was part of the Weller lineup when we bought Weller, we felt the 12-year-old was a better approach than the 10-year-old Centennial, so we abandoned that. Charter 10, we discontinued for very much the same reason as the 10-year-old Ancient Age. And while people talk about the bourbon boom, it's important to remember that it hasn't actually helped every single brand. There are some brands out there that have a different type of demographic that really haven't prospered that well. And we've got one or two of those in our portfolio. And Charter 10 being one of them where we'd seen sales decline. And again, it got to the point where it really wasn't commercially viable to continue. So, but we're, you know, by the same token, at Buffalo Trace, we've added a lot of expressions over the years too.
And let's clear up some things that have been rumored about in the blogosphere and on the internet, which is that great rumor mill that gets the entire world talking almost at times. Weller 12's not going away, right?
Weller 12 is going nowhere. We like that brand a lot. We have stocks that we're currently releasing. Demand exceeds supply by a wide margin, but we're continuing to bottle. We're continuing to ship. We have been making more. I have no idea whether what we have available for next year will get close the demand supply imbalance, or whether supply is going up twofold and demand is going up fourfold and the gap gets bigger. But we have that brand planned out over the next 20 years and we're going to make increasing amounts of it. We like it, so it's not going anywhere. You see from time to time Elmer T. Lee, people ask questions about that being discontinued, and we have absolutely no plans to discontinue that brand whatsoever. Again, we've been making more whiskey. We like that brand. The commemorative edition was a one-shot deal for us to honor Elmer. We don't have any plans to bottle any more of that. So those two brands are important to us and brands that we plan to continue producing and marketing in the years to come.
And that's with the blessing of his family too, just to emphasize that, right?
There was never a conversation around discontinuing Elmer T. Lee.
Any other brands that you keep hearing rumors or keep getting questions about? As you pointed out, your email address is pretty public. So what do you get the most questions about potential disappearing whiskeys or brands?
It's really the ones most recently have been about Elmer. And we got a few questions on Elmer about how we were going to pick barrels for Elmer, given that Elmer was not around to pick the barrels. And the answer to that question is we have a very good library of barrels that he picked, and we will continue to benchmark future selections against his library of chosen samples. So we feel very confident about being able to maintain the taste profile that people have become used to.
So how is the barrel stock going?
Well, the reason we put out the release was it had been about a year since we first wanted to really alert our customers to what's going on at the distillery. My email address sits on our website, and so I do get a fair number of emails from consumers, in particular asking about why their local package store is out of Elmer T. Lee or out of Rock Hill Farms or a brand like that. And so it occurred to us it might be a good idea to get into a rhythm and a routine of updating those, you know, our consumer base on what was going on at the distillery, because the problem really emanates with us. We just have a situation where demand is outstripping supply by a pretty wide margin, and there simply isn't enough product to supply, you know, to go around, and we're trying to figure out what's the best way to deal with it? Because I don't want to get in a situation where we just start taking price up, because I don't think it's fair to longtime loyal consumers who have supported us to suddenly just say, well, this is just going to go to the highest bidder. So raising price for us beyond the normal cost of goods really wasn't the solution. And the other thing is we are doing everything we can to maintain standards, you know, Buffalo Trace's age, Eagle Rare's age, all of those things. So we've been racking our brains as to the best way to deal with this. And the only answer we've been able to come up with is the idea of allocations. So we went ahead and hired someone. She's been in place now for about 9 months. And she takes a look at the sales forecasts and the demand side of it, matches it up to the available barrels. And of course, we have a considerable imbalance with the when the barrels turn birthday. So on an Eagle Rare 10-year-old, that whiskey might have all been made in March of a given year, which then causes you problems in a January, February timeframe. So she's marrying all that data together and then coming up with monthly allocations for our distributor network and then making sure that they get it ordered on time and get it out. So it's quite a complex process of managing it, but we're pleased with the results. It seems to be bringing some order, and it's allowing us to make sure that the country is well covered in terms of spreading the stock out.
And this is really a problem that every distiller has, is trying to get that product out at the right time and trying to anticipate that demand 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years into the future and planning for it, really, right?
Right. And I can't speak for the other distillers, but we do see enough and we hear enough to know that to some degree or another, they're all wrestling with the same basic problem. And then, of course, we have a massive challenge today trying to figure out how much whiskey do we make today in order to supply demand 10 years from now or 15 years from now. And you really have to go beyond the age of the product, because whiskey making, as you know, is a capital intensive business and also space intensive. The warehouse space required for whiskey, particularly in bourbon, is vast. And so we're really going out to 2027 with our distillation forecasts in order that we can look at still capacity and warehouse needs and all of that thing. So it's very complicated on the far side, particularly when you start winding in where we think bourbon is going in terms of China and India and Russia and Brazil in the, you know, in the next decade or two decades.
And this becomes an even bigger problem when you're having trouble getting barrels to fill the amount you need to make now to satisfy that demand 10, 12, 15 years from now.
Yeah, the bourbon barrel problem, the new bourbon barrel problem, has been well documented quite recently. And it is for real. Every distiller is extremely concerned about being able to get enough supply of new barrels to distill as much as they want to. And it's been described as a short-term problem. Our view is actually it's an ongoing problem. And I'm not entirely sure at this time that there's clear sight of a solution. It's obviously a new problem. I don't ever remember anybody talking about this as an issue. But it's contingent on so many other factors, what's going on in the housing business, what's going on in the veneer business. It is very hard for anybody with a degree of certainty to say this problem will end on this date.
And part of it is with the rain and the weather and not being able to get out into the forests and do cutting, but you also have a finite amount of forest land that generates wood that's good for barrels, as you guys have found with the Single Oak Project and other experiments over the years. There's a finite amount of wood out there that's really good for this, and you're competing for it with the home builders and everybody else, right?
Right, everybody else. The wood situation, you know, our understanding is pretty much in line with what's been reported, that people do not believe that there is actually a wood supply problem. An availability of trees, if you will. I think we are probably on the conservative end of that when it comes to believing it. If I had seen or could see more statistics to actually prove that, well, then you might feel better about it. And I think it's important to remind ourselves that the federal government owns a lot of the land that some of these trees sit on, and there isn't a clear pathway to actually being able to gain access to those trees. So it's a little bit unclear what the actual available supply in the forests of trees is. Putting aside the whole mechanism of getting them out and getting them to the barrel making companies. So again, I think that's part of why we're a little bit skeptical of these predictions that this is just a short-term problem. But obviously something's going to have to be done, because you can't make bourbon unless you're using a new oak barrel. And as we know from studying oak, there are only certain types of oak that will actually hold liquid. And, you know, I don't see anybody with an appetite to change the law. So if there is a wood problem, it's just going to have to get solved one way or another.
How would you solve it?
I think there's going to have to be a really good planning and study exercise. Do we have enough trees? Yes or no? Are they actually in sustainable, repeatable forests? Because if these trees are 40 or 50 years of age, there's going to have to be some type of consensus around, well, how many barrels is the industry going to need 10, 15 years from now? And is that tree supply actually there? And if it is there, then how exactly are we going to get it out of the forest in an orderly fashion?
And the question also then becomes, how do you make it sustainable? Because obviously you've got to plant trees to replace the ones you're taking out now, and those won't be ready for 50 to 75 to 100 years.
Right, that's a big cycle. So, you know, you could be talking about, in fact, I know you are talking about, you end up talking about millions of acres of forest land that has to be sustainable for white oak. And again, while people make reassuring noises of that, I think the industry would be smart to actually start to turn that into fact as opposed to hoping.
The bourbon industry or the forestry industry, a combination of both, the federal government and the state agencies?
I think it's a collaborative effort between and amongst interested parties.
What happens if we run out of trees? Do we have to change the law at that point to allow bourbon to be used in made in used barrels?
No. There will certainly be people that will argue for that.
As we're seeing in Tennessee already.
Yeah, I mean, I think you would unquestionably see part of the industry say, well, we're just going to have to abandon new barrels. Now, you might see a new class of whiskey show up that wasn't bourbon. Bourbon could possibly become like cognac. If you've studied cognac a little bit. It is constrained somewhat by its geography. And maybe bourbon becomes, maybe bourbon demand has to become limited, in which case you would guess that price would play a significant role in that demand curtailing. Or you suddenly find people changing the rules. I mean, we at Buffalo Trace would argue very strong to keep the rules and regs in place, intact, don't compromise bourbon, find, you know, alternative ways of making American whiskey without using new barrels, and protect bourbon at all costs, because I think that from an American product integrity standpoint of view is paramount. And we would just have to say, look, this is, as an industry, this is how much bourbon, generally speaking, you can expect to see, and manage it accordingly.
Could we get to the point where you see bourbon graded like cognac, where you have the V, the VS, the VSOP, and the very exclusive versions would have new barrels, and perhaps the lower grade bourbon would have be able to be done in used barrels?
That's a good question. Don't know. Haven't given it any thought. Obviously, the cognac grades have got multiple pieces that go into that decision set. But I think we've got lots of steps in front of us before we get to that place. But I think if the industry is not working as an industry to take a very strong look at this, and it may be that by the time the study is done, there are more than enough trees. But we'd have to be mindful, you know, American trees are very popular overseas for furniture and other types of use. So it may be fine for us to look internally, but if all of a sudden we see millions of logs going out of the country to China or to Russia or to India, that could really upset the apple cart.
Obviously, we're not going to solve all the world's problems in a 15-minute interview here, but...
oh, wouldn't it be great if we could? But
yeah.
But no. So, you know, we're obviously all collectively working on this because we want to be able to make as much whiskey as we think we need, and we want to be able to have surety of supply on new barrels.
What do you think the guys that... preceded you, guys like Elmer and Ronnie would say if they thought, good Lord, we may not have enough trees to make the bourbon we need.
I really think actually they'd be shaking their head, because all the time I spent with Elmer, that never, ever, ever came up. Not once. So I think you'd get some really odd stares.
By the way, that commemorative bottling of Elmer T. Lee bourbon is probably gone by now. The proceeds went to Elmer's longtime Veterans of Foreign Wars post in Frankfort, Kentucky. And that's this week's WhiskeyCast In Depth. Let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with the latest release from Four Roses, its annual limited edition single barrel bourbon. As I mentioned earlier, the 2014 edition is 11 years old and bottled at barrel strength, which means it will vary from bottle to bottle. My sample arrived via the Whiskey Ferry just in time to taste for this week's episode, and it was bottled at 60% ABV. The nose has great notes of clove and baked apples and peaches, brown sugar, vanilla, and toasted oak. The taste is creamy with good spicy touches of cinnamon, clove, and chili powder, along with black cherries, vanilla, and honey that add a good balance. The finish has a good sweetness with honey, pears, a hint of almonds, and a nice oakiness. It's just an excellent bourbon. I'm scoring the Four Roses 2014 Limited Edition Single Barrel a 93. I received a sample of the Glenlivet's new Nadura Oloroso a few days ago. As I mentioned last time around, this is the first permanent addition to the Nadura range since the original Nadura cask strength release in 2006. This one's bottled at 48% ABV, not quite cask strength, and the nose is fruity with green apples, green grapes, peaches, hints of ginger snap cookies, and almonds. The taste is thick and fruity with good spices, starting off with honey, apples, and ginger, followed by a burst of clove and nutmeg notes that fade out slowly to reveal touches of figs and raisins that last through the finish. I'm scoring the Glenlivet Nadura Oloroso a 92. And finally, Ardbeg won't officially release its Oro Verde's single malt until the distillery's Isla Festival Day on May 31st, but I received a sample this week. Oro Verde's combines the Portuguese words for green and gold with a subtle nod to this summer's World Cup in Brazil. It's bottled at 49.9% ABV, and the nose has notes of dark chocolate and espresso that balance nicely with Ardbeg's usual peatiness, hints of tar and creosote, graham crackers, vanilla cake frosting, and black cherries. The taste has a good peatiness with cinnamon, honey, dark chocolate, espresso, vanilla, and a hint of cherry throat lozenges. And the finish is long and peaty with a touch of honey sweetness, balanced out by baking chocolate. I'm scoring the Ardbeg Oro Verde's a 92. I'm adding these tasting notes to the searchable list of nearly 1,200 different whiskeys at whiskeycast.com. That's also where you'll find links for WhiskeyCast HD and WhiskeyCast Virtual Tastings episodes, the latest whiskey news and the calendar of events, the WhiskeyCast Photo Gallery, and our bookstore powered by Amazon.com, along with a complete archive of past episodes and much, much more. You can follow me on Twitter and Facebook at WhiskeyCast, and my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@WhiskeyCast.com.
WhiskeyCast. Proudly brought to you by Redbreast, the definitive single pot still Irish whiskey.
WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2014. And comes to you each week from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.